A decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial. I'm now here with Rusty McCrusty. So, hello Rusty.
Hello Woes.
Hello. Sorry about the late start, everyone. Things are a bit... It's the first night. Things are a bit, rusty. okay, Rusty, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Yes, sir. So I'm Rusty McRusty. Woes and I just met, I think, back in August, whenever I messaged you about my Twitter. I was suspended last year in August of 2023 after a week of being on Twitter. I still call it Twitter. And I messaged Woes, and you actually came up with a composition that I could send in, and I did, and I actually got my account back, and I've been back ever since. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. I mean, I can't remember if I wrote it specifically for you or if it was just roughly what I'd say. Because I know I've shown it to several other people, and including Jared Taylor, and it hasn't worked for him. But yeah, the way I got my account back was simply to say, well, this was obviously a mistake and I promise not to break the rules in future. That was it, you know, and it worked. So I think I just said something that you should say something similar, and it worked for you as well. So I'm glad.
Well, it never dawned on me to apologize and say that I would never do it again. So...
Well, I know it's a different atmosphere though. Where if you just come across as reasonable, then you know, they've got less reason to think, well, you know, piss off, you know, the F you kind of thing. If you just say, look, it was a mistake. I'll try not to do it in future. I didn't intend any harm. You know, that wouldn't have worked in the old days because they would have just said, no, you're right wing. So we don't care how polite you are or how civilized you are. But I think under Elon Musk's regime, they're clearly less ideological in that sense. So, yeah, they're more open-minded, let's say.
I'd say that they're certainly more bipolar in their censorship now. What was so surprising about being suspended from Twitter after just being on there for a week was... why I was suspended. It was a tweet of Ian Miles.
When did this happen, roughly?
This was August of 2023, so last year. And it was a tweet from Ian Miles Chong about the Just Stop Oil people. And it was a video of a protester that had hopped up onto the top of a car, and the car was just slightly going, you know, it wasn't going fast at all. And I just simply said, full speed ahead. And they got me on that. And I was, what?
Yeah, it's a simple joke that gets misinterpreted. Yeah, I know the kind of thing. But before we get into that, we should introduce you and what you do and who you are. So go ahead.
So after I was suspended from Twitter, I joined TikTok. And that was always the plan because I was planning on uploading TikTok videos to Twitter eventually. And so I joined TikTok, and very first video that I had, it was actually about that I was donating my testicles to Ukraine, to trans members of the armed forces of Ukraine, and advocating for harvesting fresh testicles off of dead soldiers in order to give them to trans soldiers.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. And so that one... you know, got a strike on it, and I was very first video. Okay. So then the second video I uploaded was me wearing a yarmulke, and I was just advocating for, you know, if anybody out there has any medical exemptions, for instance, I have severe sinus infections, and I just put that out there, and that got a strike too. So after that, I thought, well, shit, you know, what am I going to do? So I decided that I would change my whole profile on TikTok to being a trans supporter of Israel. And I would put the flag right. And, you know, pronouns. I've been vaccinated however many times. I'm a disabled activist artist. And ever since I, you know, changed that into somewhat of a surreptitious camouflage, I really haven't had any problems. I've only ever had one other video, and that was about 9/11 that got flagged, and they did not restore that. But other than that, it's been smooth sailing ever since.
So you pretend to be a leftist, and thus you get away with things.
I try.
I mean, I hope you're not going to spoil that by appearing on Millennial.
You know, yeah, right?
I might give the game away.
Well, I mean, I've talked about, you know, to even people on TikTok and also Twitter about, you know, being a chameleon and using certain tactics that another group uses utilizes very well. And to use those same tactics for our purposes. And I was actually very surprised, because as soon as I did that, you know, on certain videos, like the one where I was pretending to be a Jewish, you know, service member being deployed to Gaza, it was surprising how many people actually believed that. It's like, if you watch it, you know, it's got to be satire. It's got to be bullshit. But people believed it. And that's concerning, but I think that also lends credence to what a certain group of people are able to do very effectively, and people believe it. And yeah, it's shocking. Shocking and sad too.
I have to say, I'm surprised that people believed it, because I mean, you don't seem very, you don't look, you know, your facial features are not stereotypically of that group. But I guess the yarmulke would make all the difference.
Well, and here's the thing. This is what's so funny, because even people on the right were confused about it. Certain, you know, automatons. And I spoke to this guy, or not spoke to him, but messaged him. And I believe he was from Albania. And he was saying, oh, no, I think that you're probably one of them. I can't really tell, because, like, you know, the hat, the nose. That was the first time that anyone ever said that I had a certain nose. I've been accused of having a nose of a different group, but certainly not that one. So even people on the right get confused by that shit.
Right. Yeah. I can see. Well, obviously, there is a lot of paranoia in the right about people infiltrating and so forth. Yep. And that's been a thing for as long as I can remember. I mean, I've been accused of being a Jewish transvestite. That's the thing I always mention, because I think it's so funny. It's ridiculous. Like, of all the things.
Well, that's what I portray on TikTok. So.
Oh, of all the allegations, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There are people who go looking for this kind of thing. But yeah, so how would you describe your videos and TikTok? I guess we could talk specifically about that. That it is a.
Yeah.
How does it differ? Because I think most people who are familiar with me will be familiar with YouTube as a platform, but probably a lot of them, including me, are not that familiar with TikTok. Obviously, there's a certain generational stereotype here that TikTok is for the Zoomers and YouTube is for the Boomers and down to Millennials. But let's leave that kind of stuff aside. How would you describe TikTok as a platform compared to YouTube?
Much easier. Much easier to get views, easier to escape censorship. You can say a lot more. You can be more clever. There's more freedom, I think, on TikTok right now. And there's, of course, you know, the threatening ban that's supposed to happen supposedly in January. But I think for a lot of people, and this was what was so surprising for me with TikTok, I thought TikTok was just, you know, bullshit, you know, just people, you know, singing to little videos and doing dances and all that type of thing. But once you get on there, I think it would, because of how the good the algorithm is, it kind of figures out what you're into pretty quick. And it starts recommending some things that I think that a lot of people who are not familiar with TikTok would be very surprised about. And that's one thing that I kind of wanted to get into in terms of like what you've been discussing recently on Twitter about like culture, in terms of like, you know, EU versus Americans and whatnot. And I know that Americans tend to, you know, shit on Europeans, you know, like British people having bad teeth, you know, or, you know, the French being weirdos or whatever. But, and that's all joking. That's just that little banter type thing, you know. But what's interesting about it, you know, whenever you get past the little jokes about like Europeans or whatever, is that Americans will shit on their ancestral homeland. They will shit on their brothers and on the European people, their own people. Okay. And I think that not only that, they could get, you know, us to fight two world wars and go against each other. So I think in terms of like culture, we will shit on each other before we shit on anyone else. And specifically, people will talk about how horrible Europe is, you know, the French are cowards, they retreat, whatever, and really disparaging stuff. But you never hear them say a single fucking thing about Israel. They will defend that. And getting back into the TikTok part of it, what I think a lot of people would be surprised about is the amount of videos of Enoch Powell that are on there. The painter, man. Thousands upon thousands of likes and reposts. Lots of things about the truth about Churchill, the truth of surrounding World War II, surrounding COVID, a bunch of stuff. It was very surprising. And I think that in terms of that, that's like an untapped market for the right. And I think that that is something that needs to be tapped into because so many Zoomers are on TikTok.
Well, is this... I don't actually know. Is there a video length limit on TikTok?
That you can personally upload or...
Yeah, like, could a video, like a millennial interview, for example, an hour and a half?
I'm not sure on, like, time frames. Right. I think they've gotten up to, like, 10 minutes. I'm not sure because I've never really looked into that. I think TikTok's more relegated towards, you know, shorter videos. The thing is, people with short attention spans. As for something like millennial, maybe like brief little clips of fun little highlights or whatever. But as for people actually watching it, the full thing, I don't know about that. Maybe you can go live on TikTok, I know.
Right. I just wondered, it just occurred to me right now, is that viable? I mean, I've never created an account on TikTok. I think there already was a millennial, but someone had taken the ID. So I thought, well. And I just left it. But I do sometimes see videos linked on Twitter or whatever, and I'll go over to TikTok and look at them. But that's really the extent of my experience of TikTok. It does sound amazing. The things you've been describing, I don't think they were even on YouTube prior to Susan Wojcicki's era. Like in 2014... When I started, it was 2014, and I think even before that, like 2012, 2013, 2011, I don't think, like, World War II has always been a very protected area, very protected topic, for obvious reasons, and it is the basis of our world today, the worldview that we're all meant to have, and we don't need to go into the details of it, everyone knows.
Yeah.
But it's always been very protected. It's amazing to think that TikTok is free even on that topic. And is that why it is being targeted now and has been for a couple of years now in America?
Yeah, I think that that's kind of getting back to my point about how, you know, Americans will, you know, say such horrible things about Europeans and whatnot, is that because of those particular videos, that it's seen as a threat because it's waking so many, I wouldn't say it's waking a lot of people up, but it's making people more aware to reality and to the hidden truths, especially for the up and coming younger generation. I think that that's the big reason why it's such a threat. Now, you still have to be careful, of course, but the big thing was the translated AI speeches into English. That was the big one. And the thing was, is that the ones that did not like have any scenery of, you know, like World War II or that, you know, the Third Reich era or anything like that, it could be, you know, a video of just a nature scene, but it's the narrated, translated speech.
I think that this is actually a very new thing, because people have always heard those speeches translated by a narrator and only bits of it and so on. So to hear it translated directly by AI or whatever now is a new experience for a lot of people, because it opens them up to the possibility that World War II didn't need to happen, that the Nazis didn't want to take over the entire world. They didn't want to destroy Britain and the British Empire. They didn't want to conquer America and so on. So therefore, Churchill was actually the villain and Roosevelt was the villain. And this whole thing didn't actually need to happen. Now, without going into the attributes of the Third Reich itself, that alone is a huge wake-up call for people. The idea that actually he wasn't a warmonger in that sense, certainly not from the point of view of the West. The West didn't have much to fear. So that alone is a huge problem, because it ruptures the whole worldview that, as I say, we're all meant to have.
Yeah.
That we rescued the West and saved our countries and so on, especially when you look at what's become of our countries ever since then. So it is an interesting thing for sure. And I think, you know, there has been this archetype of the base Zoomer for some time now. I can't remember when it was first talked about, maybe at least 5 years ago. If I looked through the millennial archives, we might find people talking about it in 2015 for all I know, but I don't think it was what goes that far back.
Yeah.
But it does seem that TikTok is a central reason for that.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's mostly men. But it would also be surprising to people as well how many women and young women are starting to post some pretty based shit on TikTok. You get on there, and like I said, I think that was like a big shocker to me, is just how much content of the right was on there, but also how much potential there is. That's the big one.
Did Jonathan Bowden clips get shared a lot?
No, but David Irving is very, very popular.
Right, okay.
Bowden, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the name.
Oh, Jonathan Bowden. Oh, he was an English speaker, orator, writer. He died 12 years ago, but he was very big in the right-wing scene.
Did he wear thick glasses?
Well, yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about now, yeah.
It would always be sort of grainy camcorder footage of a man in a pub, you know, that kind of thing, yeah.
Okay.
That was
I know what you're talking about.
Now that you ask me, did he have glasses, I'm trying to think, did he actually have... I can't remember. Yes, he did.
Okay, well, no, I know what you're talking about now, okay.
Yeah. Well, clips of him go around on Twitter an awful lot. I think it's such a tragedy that he died, because I think now he would be a huge figure on social media because, well, he's popular. I mean, the clips of him are so popular now. But yeah, let me see what we're going to talk about next, because it was obviously TikTok is a very interesting platform, and I think they're probably... people on the right could be making a lot more use of it than they are. I know that Keith Woods tried and he got banned immediately. And I suspect that the same might happen to me if I were to create a channel on there, but I haven't done it yet. So we don't know.
You
for
need
sure.
to order a yarmulke. You got a nice haircut. So
maybe.
What was his style?
Yeah. So let's get on to the next thing, which is the US election. And what it means for the dissident right in Europe and America. The thing about Americans, because you've made a few comments about Americans shitting on Europe, and I did actually experience this recently. And, you know, I tried to avoid infighting, and certainly I try to avoid causing infighting as much as possible. And Millennial is really an attempt to do the opposite of that, to bring people together and heal these divisions as much as possible. But about a month ago, I had this experience where that guy, what's his name? Mike Cernovich, had said something bitchy. And he was, to be fair to him, he was replying to another bitchy comment about America. But he replied, and that brought all of his alt-light fans into this thing about shitting on Europe.
Yeah.
And so I replied to him, or retweeted him or something, and then that brought his fans on to me. And it was all really unpleasant. And I just see it as something that it cannot benefit any of us. It doesn't benefit the Europeans. It doesn't benefit the Americans. It's just dumb. It's just stupid. It's pointless. Even if the Americans are right or the Europeans are right, it doesn't matter. Only our mutual enemies benefit from this. So for God's sake, can we not fight each other and denigrate each other? It's just retarded.
Well, and like I said, so many Americans will talk such horrendous shit about Europe, and they come, you know, their ancestors are from Europe, but, you know, they will hold, and Israel's our greatest ally, and, you know, it seems like so much of a psyop, but it's just so bizarre to, especially in real life, whenever you're trying to talk to people, you know, in the real world, not just online. I mean, it's astounding how far brainwashed these people are. And
It's definitely something that's in the right wing in America, far more than it's in the left wing in America, actually.
But you have those automatons, and then they get online, and those are your alt-like people, you know, the followers of Cernovich, which we all know who Cernovich is, that, you know, of that kind of hearing.
Definitely. So to get to the U.S. election and what it means for the distant right in Europe and America. That's obviously a huge topic, but it is one that is going to be addressed on Millennial probably an awful lot. Oh, yeah. So you've kind of got the first go at this. What are your general thoughts on that? I mean, I said with White Papers a couple of hours ago that it looks like Trump is not the same as he was in 2016, that this is a like dark MAGA kind of that meme that was going around, that he's going to be different this time. What do you think about this, the general ramifications for America first? Let's take that.
Well, I think in terms for Americans, it puts a whole lot of people back to sleep. That's a big problem. Showing that allowing Trump to win, that showed people, oh, maybe, you know, our elections aren't suspicious. And it's put so many people back to sleep. I mean, as much as it pains me to say it, like with Kamala, I think that would have made a lot of people on the right realize just how bad things are. I think getting into like some of the other things that you and I've talked about, like in terms of depression, you know, whenever you have severe depression, you usually don't change things until you're at the very bottom, until you're at your very last. Whenever you are, you know, pounding that floor, not knowing what to do, when you seem so lost, but then you decide to pick yourself up. I think that causes action in people, and that stirs a change, and it makes people want to change. And as horrible as that may sound, I think that's what needs to happen, is people need to see, and we need to get to the very bottom for people to, for the majority, for the alt-light people, for those automatons to finally wake up and for change to actually happen. Because it's going to take the normies. We always talk about being able to control the narrative, like certain people are able to, and to be able to carry that and to be able to use that as a tool, but we don't have the platforms for it. I think that's one reason why TikTok is so valuable to us and why we should tap into that. But we need to have that stirring, you know, passion in us that makes us get up and actually do something. And By Donald Trump being elected, all that did was make the majority of the normies go back to sleep and just think, oh, everything's A-OK until the next 4 years.
Well, indeed. And that the question is what he will do with those 4 years, but also what will happen at the end of them. And that's and of course, that might be affected by what he does. He might make legislative changes here and there, the Supreme Court judges and all this, which ensure a sort of lasting legacy. Or he might not. But either way, there is the question of what will happen once he's out of power. Mm. And you're right, that it might be the Democrats again, or it might be some awful, you know, lame Republican who gets in. I don't know. But in the interim, you've got this opportunity for him to do things. And I think, see, the way this seems to me is, I think it's going to be good for Americans in the sense of material betterment. I think they...
Oh, yeah.
It's probably... I see it being like the 80s again. Maybe it won't. But I can imagine a second 80s where you've got mass consumerism and success and competition, wealth, sort of rank material prosperity, and people being quite shallow about it, like the stereotype 80s stuff, the yuppie, all of that.
Yes.
I can see that being America over the next 4 years or even longer. And then meantime, Europe just sinks into the mire because it's partly because of America's success and power. I mean, look at Nord Stream, you know, that kind of thing, where America sabotages another country really to make it to impoverish it. That's mm-hmm. going to be the effect of that on Germany. It's going to have to deindustrialize. It doesn't have cheap energy. It's going to affect everything in Europe, I would say. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I don't see how it can't be that way. So that's I could see a terrible divide here where America's just doing really well. Everyone's rich and making money and all that. And then in Europe, it's just a backwater where nothing works anymore. And everyone's just depressed and miserable and trying desperately to get to the promised land of America. That sounds awful.
You know, I don't know if America would even be considered the promised land anymore. I certainly wouldn't consider that. In terms of prosperity, I think that it may appear that way, but the vast majority of Americans are struggling. And the Trump coming in, it's going to take a lot more work for Trump this round than the last time. He kind of had it a tad bit more easy than what he's coming into now with the kind of inflation and everything like that we have. So I'm not just, in terms of like prosperity, I'm not exactly sure about that. I think America's a bit better off than Europe, of course, but you know, as the empire starts to wane, things for the everyday person here are kind of going downhill.
Well, that's what he seems to be focused on reversing, or at least slowing down, the decline of the American empire. So that's why I think he's going to try to energize the economy and the trade tariffs for imports and all this to bring everything back into America in-house. So all the offshoring that's been done, the globalizing that's been done, I can imagine him wanting to reverse a lot of that so that the guy who works at the plant can afford to raise a family of three kids in a nice house in suburbia and the wife doesn't have to work, like in the 50s. The 50s utopia that America enjoyed. I can imagine that, after all, that is Trump's childhood. I mean, he remembers that as that's what's in his head as Americana. So I could see that I'm trying to recreate that.
And I certainly hope that he does, but, you know, I think like the whole thing about like, you know, a guy being able to support a family at a plant job and whatnot, that's kind of a past dream from the 50s. And, you know, we don't make anything in America anymore. Right now, Stellantis, that produces Jeep, Dodge, and Ram, in Chrysler, they are having huge, major problems, and they're planning on moving a whole hell of a ton of production down to Mexico. So more things are moving down there. Now, with Trump coming in with the tariffs, I don't know if that's going to change. But the thing is that so many, in his first term, things came back. A few things came back from Mexico to the United States. What happened 4 years later? They all went back to Mexico, if not more. So you go through this ebb and flow, this roller coaster of every 4 years of uncertainty. So in terms of, even if you could have a Trump presidency where he does bring back a lot of that prosperity, what happens in 4 years?
And another part of this is that he is a civic nationalist. I mean, he is very clearly very fond of America. He loves America. I think that is genuine. But he's definitely not an actual nationalist, even though he should be, because the America that he values depends on there being a supermajority of white people, white Americans. But nonetheless, he isn't. He believes in race-blind civic nationalism.
Well, it's more about the economy. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So whatever he does to the economy, you've still got the demographic threat. That's the thing that I was getting towards saying.
Well, and he thinks every other group, he thanked the Indians, he thanked, literally every other group, but the group that elected him.
Well, yeah, this is the whole thing about how he lost the share of the white vote in 2020 compared to 2016. I don't know if that was reversed in this recent one. I think it was.
Yeah.
But he screwed them. I mean, he just didn't do anything for white America because he couldn't even acknowledge that there is such a thing as white America. He couldn't name it. So they felt neglected, rightly, and so they didn't vote for him. They're giving him a second chance now, but that's a large part of that is simply because the alternatives are so dreadful. They're even worse.
Yeah, I think that was a big deal, is that the candidate was bad, the economy is super bad, so it was not based on any kind of politics, of what is best for us. And there, it's funny because even with the black demographic, they still vote heavily for, the Democrats and whatnot.
I think they vote with that group
mentality.
Yeah, was it not something like 95% of blacks voted for Kamala?
I think it was something astonishing. It was split between the sexes. I think like 93% went to women. I don't remember the men.
Yeah. That, I think it was definitely for the women. It was huge. Maybe it wasn't so bad for the men, but yeah, the point is, if a Republican tries to court the black vote, it's just he's on a hiding to nothing. It's just crazy, completely ridiculous. And I think it always has been that way certainly for our lifetimes. It's a stupid thing. But the point is, and I think this relates to what you were going to talk about, is that a better economy will put white Americans back to sleep. And then so that their demographic erasure can just proceed unopposed because they'll think it's all fine. That's a huge danger.
All Trump is injecting a little bit more life support into the dying corpse that is America. And this might be a poor analogy, but America is riddled with cancer. And what we do is we go in and maybe take a little bit out, but then we leave some. And so it always grows. And so all that, Trump being elected did was just, further postpone things, but our numbers are going to keep on going down. He's talking about, stamping green cards to the back of diplomas. He's all for that. He is all for demographic replacement. Look at, Vivek Ramaswamy, who's part of the Dodge thing with Elon Musk. He is a huge advocate for, people coming over, his own people. Sorry, what?
Yeah, and Trump wants the high IQ. This is the thing. He wants America as an economy to be competitive, so he wants the high IQ Indians.
Yeah.
But that doesn't address the problem that the white American public, that the white American people are being dispossessed.
Exactly, and it's just given that, little lifeline 4 more years. but things are going to still get better. Things will get better for everybody in whites, you know, in probably terms of economy and things like that. But in terms of our people, in terms of our numbers, they are going further and further down. And there is nothing that is being addressed that's being promoted to address that. And that's another thing, too, is that there's nobody in the United States, there's nobody on the right that is willing to step up and be our advocate. And that's what we need. And I think that that's what a lot of the alt-light people, those, you know, automatons think of Trump as he's this savior, this be-all savior, and he's not. I think it's more so of a wolf in sheep's clothing type deal.
Mm. Yeah, and dare I ask, what do you think about J.D. Vance?
Oh, and his wife? I mean, he's already wearing the eyeliner. All he needs is the little dot, you know, the little third eye. And we have it made. But J.D. Vance, if you read his book, I tried to, it disparages whites. It disparages his own people. Well, I think Devin Stack put out a thing about J.D. Vance, you know, and the Indian, you know, his Indian Christmas and whatnot, is that he puts his wife's family above, you know, his own, and how disparaging he is towards, you know, people in Appalachia, just towards whites in general. He's not on our side. And that's another thing that's so amazing, is that all of these people will drink that Kool-Aid and think that Trump and Vance are these weird ass saviors, and they're just not. It's so astounding how, you know, I know brainwash, but using that, but it really is astounding seeing these automatons just go out there and believe this shit.
Well,
and
yeah,
it's frustrating. I'm lost for words.
I think a big part of it is that they desperately want to believe it, and I feel this myself. You know, I like the idea of America being revived and being okay, being wealthy. I wish it didn't impact negatively Europe, obviously, but nonetheless, I like the idea of Americans being happy, you know, white Americans being successful and prosperous and all that. But as you say, the price of that is complacency and forgetting about, cause, and this is the whole thing, that a year ago things were reaching ahead with, you know, like the wokery and the universities being taken over by vengeful brown people who were very open about certain issues. They didn't have the white guilt holding them back. They didn't have all of the training, the propaganda. So in a sense, that was good, because it meant that they were open about the people who, let's say, an international tribe, but they were also open about their opposition, their loathing of white people. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of useful, because it woke white people up to the danger that they're in. And what might well happen now is that those people will just fall silent. They'll realize that they've got to be, you know, hide their power level, basically. And then they'll, but it will keep incubating. And demographically, eventually it will reach a point where they can be open again. And actually start doing things, actually start just openly dispossessing the legacy white population. I mean, this is really serious. I remember in Sweden a few years ago, somehow their heritage minister, I think it was heritage, whoever was in charge of the stuff, was, I think she was a black woman, and she ordered the destruction of Viking artifacts. And I remember thinking, I mean, it's dreadful, and I was shocked and appalled by this. But then I also thought, well, what do you expect? It's not hers. It's not her heritage. She can only be offended by it. She can only be outraged by it. It would take enormous humility for her not to be, for her to be respectful about it. And what a lot of them will do is they won't elevate themselves to that. They'll instead feel the base racial resentment and loathing of that thing which does not include them. that's just one case in Sweden. Once they're more numerous and in positions of power and authority throughout the West, I think you can expect much more of that. That museum won't get funding. That art collection or archaeology dig or whatever won't get the funding, won't get the resources that it needed. And so they'll fall by the wayside. But that is what the reality of a foreign people being in charge of your country. Yeah. And this would be common sense to our ancestors. It's really just the last few generations who have fallen into total ignorance about these realities.
Well, and there's also a lot of heritage Americans that were incentivized during, when all the statues were coming down in America, not just the Confederate statues, but, statues of Thomas Jefferson, of Washington, and other, founding fathers and, various other statues. But it wasn't just a certain demographic of people that are, not heritage Americans. There were heritage Americans that, like I said, whether they be incentivized or just have some self-hatred, loathing within themselves for being white, that they have been, once again, propagated to believe this. And so it's our own people. And that's another thing, too, is that when our own people are working against us, and they're the ones that are carrying the torch, and that's one thing in America that that some heritage Americans are still in certain power positions, but they have to do that virtue signaling. So if statues fall or whatever, they'll do it. So, it's our own people too.
Yeah, there's a huge problem with that. But again, I think that's largely generational. I mean, I might be wrong about this, but I suspect that once the boomers are not working in these positions anymore, once they all retire, I think there will be a cultural shift. I mean, Gen X are pretty bad as well, but I just see it being not total in the way that it seems to be with the boomers. The generations below that seem to be more polarized, whereas with the boomers, virtually every single one of them is a race-blind civic nationalist, desperate to believe that race doesn't matter, but white people are bad, but race still doesn't matter. I think the younger ones, including Gen X, don't really believe that. Race is a reality for them, partly because of the woke politics of the last 10, 15 years. But then that leads naturally to, well, if race is a reality, then white people are a reality. So at that point, it becomes very difficult to maintain the fiction that white people uniquely just don't exist.
Yeah.
Everyone else does, but we just don't. We've got no identity. We've got no culture. It's obviously untrue, and it's obviously illogical as well. It just doesn't actually make sense.
Well, and that even goes back to the point of why it's so easy for so many people in America to, talk shit on Europeans.
That is a thing. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
Oh, no worries. I'm sorry. This is my first time being live and everything, so I'm like pretty nervous. But this is such an honor to be on here and whatnot. Terms of my thoughts and everything, I'm like, oh, I said brainwashed a bunch and everything, so I'm rather disjointed. But
Don't worry about that. You're doing fine. No, I realize it's a bit nerve-wracking sometimes, but don't worry, it's all fine. All right, so one thing you wanted to talk about was, comparing the current situation with and what you see as the future in America to a book, Civil War, to The Coming Breakup of America by Thomas W. Chittum.
Yes.
Talk about that.
So in terms of, first of all, Thomas W. Chittum was a soldier in Vietnam. He went on to be a mercenary in Rhodesia and then later on in the former Yugoslavia. And these are just some things that he has noticed and whatnot. Whenever you read the book, you can read it on Internet Archive, Civil War II, The Coming Breakup of America. You read it and it's absolutely prophetic. I mean, it's like reading what's actually happening in real time. The man hit the nail on the head whenever he wrote it. And at the very end of the book, there is a Civil War II checklist. And look at that checklist. And we've checked, we're checking off boxes, you know, as days go by. It's astounding. just how right this guy was. There's a few things that are kind of wonky, but for the most part, he was like a prophet with this shit.
Oh, was he talking about like the breakdown of civil social cohesion, that kind of thing?
Exactly. And about also demographic change, incoming, you know, illegal immigration and things like that. One thing that was interesting that he specifically mentioned was in Florida about court cases about voodoo and animal sacrifice. You know, dogs and cats being ate and being sacrificed for voodoo rituals. And that in certain parts of Florida, you will see, you know, these sacrifices on the court lawns and stuff outside of these courthouses. And then, you know, he talks about some other things that, like, holy shit, this guy's talking about Springfield, Ohio, and other things. And he even, at one point, predicted when things would kick off. And he was within just a few days of whenever George Floyd passed away. And that's not to, like, say that, you know, he was, you know. But the things that he puts in the book, he talks about, for one thing, the Reconquista of the Southwest. Are you familiar with the Reconquista in Aztlan?
No.
So the Reconquista is basically reconquering of the Southwest, conquering the territories that were ceded to the United States in 1848 during the Mexican-American War. So Texas, New Mexico, up into Colorado, California, Arizona, those types. And how demographic replacement in the Southwest will eventually lead to it being a de facto state of Mexico. And one thing he talks about as well is about bilingual, being forced to, for job applications and things like that, for it to be bilingual. And in the state of New Mexico, in Texas, that is a reality now for governmental, for certain governmental positions. And also, it should be noted that this book was written in the early 90s.
So, right, okay. So, I was imagining this was from the 50s or something. But yeah, that's... see, this thing about the bilingual, I've heard that that's not just in the Southwest of America, but quite like because Hispanics are everywhere.
Oh, now, yeah. So, I think it's become more popular, you know, everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking, really. You'd think that if anything would be relatively straightforward to enforce, it would be a language. Like, the English is the language of America. It's the language of the United States. I can't believe that that was... Obviously, it was deliberately, like, go off. I realize that.
But, yeah, in fact, I actually have it right here. I have a whole book collection behind me. But, yeah, in terms... I think that... getting back to, like, your whole thing about, like, America being prosperous and everything. Once again, I think that that's just, like, a four-year thing. I mean, we go through this roller coaster every 4 years. This is a... like I said, America is dying. We're pumping life support into something. We're just waiting for this to happen. It's only a matter of time before things actually do implode and go downhill. Look at America's debt. And I don't mean to be sound blackpilling with that, but I think that this situation in America and with the empire is a lot more dire than what, you know, a lot of people think.
So do you see this devolving into a civil war situation in America, regardless of whatever Trump does?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And one thing that Chittum talks about is once the demographics, you know, once the white population does get below about 60 or 50%, that's when you'll start to see things. And we already see how things are so rapidly degrading in America now. I mean, get on a road, go to North Carolina right now, and the help that those people have received. Once again, them being Appalachians, mostly white. But yeah, once the demographic replacement's in place and that imperial conversion happens, yeah, that's... Read the book, people. I'm horrible at explaining this, but read it for yourselves and, you know, you'll see.
And do you think, because one other note you made was that about Americans returning to Europe. Of course, a lot of Americans have never been to Europe, but you mean in the ancestral sense of an exodus back to the old world. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I shared my DNA with you, that I sent you and whatnot. If I returned to Scotland, I would be kind of that weird, eccentric American guy, right? My heritage, my ancestors might be from Scotland, but I'm still American. But you know, like if I had children, over time there would be that kind of course correction and they would revert back into that natural state of being a Scotsman, of being a German, whatever, of being European. I think that a lot in terms, because of the demographic replacement in America, America's done. I mean, there might be little enclaves and whatnot, but I think like we either need a new homeland or and go back to our old one and merge back into you, into being European, into that natural state. I think
it's a very interesting idea. It's something that I've said myself that I think, I don't like saying it because it sounds like I'm pronouncing on what Americans should do or what any other people should do, any for other country. And it's obviously not my place to do that, but I could see it. A lot of Americans doing this. Just a brief aside, someone's picked up on you saying that you sent me your DNA. I want to make clear that it's not a requirement for appearing on Millennial that you send me your DNA. Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking like, no, I didn't like send, you know, like send you any actual DNA. It was
No, of course not. I don't need to see your results. It's not a requirement. Just to be clear on that.
I was only sharing that because I'm a good proportion of me is Scottish. So I was just wanted to show you that because I'm proud of that.
Yeah, exactly. Just in case anyone was wondering about the selection procedure for a millennial.
requirements.
Anyway, but yeah, I could see a lot of Americans doing that because it's one of those things where it's, again, I'm speaking as an outsider to America. I'm not declaring that you should do this or that this is the reality, but as an outsider, it seems like America could have been more of a country, more of a culture than it has become, but that it was thwarted about 100 years ago, maybe a bit longer, and sent down a different path, which has led it to be what it is now. And I'm not condemning what it is now. I'm just saying it's not as much of a country. It's not as much of a, it's not as rooted as it could have been.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, the promise that it once held has been unfulfilled. And you could say, some people have said, that the experiment has failed. Now, I don't like speaking in those absolutist terms, but I can see a lot of Americans thinking like that and concluding that the best course of action is indeed to return to the old world. Europe. I think we can call it Europe. Sorry, you go.
Well, and that's why we need to repair that, you know, opinion that Americans hold, you know, instead of shitting on Europe, for them to be able to see how great Europe is, to see the majesty and the prestige of what they came from as a people and make them proud of that, for them to see that and to realize that and to see how great that is, to be able to not just convince them to go home, but also to, hey, look at what we came from. Let's go back, not only preserve that, but build upon it. And that's why we need to repair that whole thing with Americans shitting on Europe or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't like it. And whenever I fall into, making jokes about hamburgers or Walmart or whatever, I always think afterwards that wasn't the best side of me, let myself down there.
We have Buc-ee's. I think I tweeted you, we have Buc-ee's, the Beaver. It's the largest gas station in the world down in Texas. And the mascot is a beaver, and people go and like rub the beaver and whatnot. And so, and that's what's kind of funny about things, especially in Texas, is that there are more people, well, not more people, I don't know exact numbers, but that's such a destination for people. People want to go to Buc-ee's, but people, Alamo. But Buc-ee's, let's go rub the beaver.
Yeah, I understand.
Let's go get some beaver nuggets.
Yeah. I think that a lot of Americans, as you said, would fit in. And this is the thing. I mean, in every town in Britain, every city, there are plenty, certainly in the cities, there are plenty of Americans. Even in my hometown, there are Americans. I remember them. I've met them. And they do fit in. There's no big problem. There's no big cultural disconnect. Yeah. It's fine. And of course, their kids are just, they completely blend in. There's no big problem there either.
Yeah, I mean, if you saw me walking down the street, you wouldn't,
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that proves that, if Americans immigrated back to Europe, we, in terms of merging and everything, no problems. But that shows you whenever people are from a different part of the world that are not heritage, and do not come from that, that it just doesn't work. But, if we did it, it would.
Yeah, it would. But as some people in the chat are pointing out, what's the point of moving back to Europe? Because someone's saying he's not going to uproot himself and move back to Europe or whatever, when Europe has the same problems. And this is a very legitimate point to make. I mean, we've got... Because people often say, well, Britain's fucked. I'm going to move to Sweden. As if Sweden's not equally fucked. And France, Germany, Netherlands, or indeed America. There are people here talking about moving to America, even while you say that the reverse should happen. I think a lot of people don't quite realize it really is it's bad everywhere. I mean, there is nowhere left to run to. I remember someone saying to me years ago, a sort of liberal girl who was saying, if you want a white ethnostate, why don't you just move to Sweden? And I said, well, I didn't say anything to her because I realized it was futile, but obviously in her head, Sweden is still ABBA country. It's still just Bjorn and Benny strumming a guitar. And everything's fine, and everyone's blonde, and it's like this dream vision of a whiteopia. And it's not. It is absolutely not. I think that people, wherever you go, you're going to find the refugees, you're going to find the Indians, you're going to find the Chinese, you're going to find the Muslims, and the Africans. It's a problem because it affects everywhere. There's nowhere left to run to. But over and above that, at least the problems that are inserted into the debate with America, where, the smallpox blankets, the Native Americans were wiped out, slavery, Jim Crow, and all this, there's none of that in Europe. The most you can say is, well, Europeans came from Africa originally, but that's... Even that, if you believe that, which it isn't exactly true, but even if you believe it, it's still a stupid argument to make because it goes back like 50,000 years. It's retarded.
I think that I've had people on TikTok argue about this. I mean, look at Birmingham. How would we ever take Birmingham back? But in terms of Europe, I think that Europeans have a deeper sense of being rooted to what it means to be a Swede, what it means to be an Englishman, whereas Americans are so far removed from that. Once again, we shit on Europe all the time. We do not have that connection in America. We don't have, you know, oh, it's just another white guy or whatever. But in Sweden, there's actual Swedes to bring that situation back to it just being Swedes or whatever. And yet there might be still some people there, but you're going to have Swedes. They're white, they're Swedes, but they're not all these other mixed, you know, different white people or whatever. And so in terms of reestablishing Europe back to Europe, I think because you guys are more in tuned and ingrained because y'all are all British or whatever, or all Scottish and whatnot.
Yeah,
that there's that grounding for it. And so that, you know, in terms of reestablishing Europe, with what will eventually happen in Europe, I think that you're going to see, you know, just like in America, there's going to be a downfall and all sorts of war and, you know, it's going to be horrible. But in reestablishing that, people in, you know, Sweden, because they're all Swedes, they're going to have an easier time doing that. Whereas in America, it's going to be absolute chaos. And there's not that camaraderie and that connection with a fellow Swede. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, I understand. Americans are very deracinated. I think that might be the word you were looking for. It's a word that's been used quite a lot in our circles. And again, this is part of the thing that I mentioned earlier, because I don't think that that was the case 100 years ago. I think that Americans 100 years ago were rooted far more than they are today. And they still had, they even, I was amazed when I learned this, that they still had their ancestral languages. Like German was spoken in a lot of America.
Yeah. My grandmother's family is from Pennsylvania. And she was born in 1921, and it was a bilingual household. But that's the thing, is that whenever she went to school, whenever business and things like that were conducted, they spoke fluent English.
Yeah. Of course. And that was the process of integration that for a long time seemed just an overall unalloyed good. Whereas now we realize that that's actually part of homogenization, which then prepares the whites involved for absorption into the globalist, the global homo. Yeah. I remember.
In terms of like Americans moving back to Europe, to like a European homeland, I'm not talking about like that now, you know, oh, I'm going to pick up and, you know, move to Scotland or whatever. I'm talking about like what comes after. What comes after whenever Europeans reestablish Europe? We'll put it that way. After Civil War II and everything like that, once the smoke settles for us to go back and to rebuild and things like that, and it would be a lot easier.
Yeah, well, obviously there's a lot of historical developments that would have to happen, but I think will happen one way or another. I mean, history is going to be written. It's going to happen. You can't actually stop it. So the question is whether it's going to be in our favor or not, but you know, it is going to happen. I mean, things are not going to stay as they are. And again, I think a lot of people find that difficult to believe, you know, because we've, at least in some countries, we've gone a long, long time without war, without conflict, without upheaval. Yeah. So people tend to think, well, nothing ever really happens. But that can only be sustained for so long, even in the best possible world.
That's one thing about Americans, is Americans haven't fought a war on American soil for, well, since basically the Civil War. And so that's something that we're unfamiliar with, and we cannot grasp that, oh, that could ever happen in America again, or, you know, something of those absolute cataclysmic upheaval. It's hard for people to imagine, but it's happened before. It's just not within recent memory.
Yeah, indeed. It seems like all of our countries, but especially America, since we're focusing on that, are poised for great turmoil. And so you can't expect things to just continue as they are. Clearly, there's going to be change. I mean, obviously, one thing that's touted and talked about is balkanization or secession, yeah. where America would split apart in various ways. What do you think about that scenario?
In terms of like referencing the book, I think that there's going to be, once the dust settles, maybe, but there's going to be enclaves. It's not going to be like what you can think of in terms of like, you know, reestablishing a kind of set boundary country, at least at first. But there's going to be, you know, enclaves of blacks, of Hispanics. And I think that the majority of whites will once again be further pushed back and back and probably end up, you know, up north, as we always do. But one thing, like whenever I went to Europe, really quick, you know, and that's a good, you know, the race and nation, like in America, we have no connection or whatever. It's all basically, you know, America, you know, in that own individual culture. And so growing up, you know, there was no form of solidarity with whites or anyone like that. You're just, you know, Americans, football, all of that type of shit. And whenever I went back to Europe the first time, that's what I was so surprised about, is that as an American, I always thought, well, I can always go back to Europe, and because, you know, Europe's European, you know, Scotland is where my people originally came from. That's full of Scotsmen. So I can go back there and be around Scotsmen. But then, you know, as soon as you step off the plane, you know, what do you see? And so, you know, growing up as a child, that's what I always thought, is that, you know, oh, well, you know, America's this way, but, you know, Europe's not. We can always go back there and it'll be great. And that wasn't the case. And that was so shocking. And
up to the 90s, it probably pretty much was the case. You know, but yeah, not now.
And so there was that noticeable change in just how quick that happened. Whereas in America, it was, you know, being born in the 90s, you know, you don't exactly see that. But it's been taking place so long in America, it's just been like a little trickle. Whereas like in Europe, I mean, boom, they just dumped the bucket on y'all.
Yeah. Sorry, I was distracted there by the Rumble chat. Somebody suggested that I go and look at it because I've been neglecting it. I am sorry. It's difficult to do all these different things at once. But yeah, I think that, well, I wanted to ask you about secession and balkanization. Do you see any scenarios where that could resolve America's problem and at the existential level? I mean, breathe new life into that, the project of America, let's say. Or do you think that's just not going to happen?
No. I mean, that's another thing, like every 4 years or whatever, you know, you hear, oh, you know, California's going to secede or Texas is going to secede. I mean, we've been hearing about secession for a long ass time. In fact, in Texas, there's, I believe it's called the Texas Nationalist Movement, and they're pro-secessionist. And because I think Texas is like the 8th largest economy in the world, if it was a country. But I really don't see that happening. I don't think Chittum really sees that happening either. America's just going to implode and everything's just going to be chaos and secession. That would take an organization. And what he talks about more is just it breaking up in total chaos. And in terms of like a secession happening successfully, I don't think so.
All right. Okay, then. Well, you also, to change the subject somewhat, I mean, obviously, these are big issues, and they will be discussed by other people as well, but it's all coming to the fore in a way because of the Trump election. It is quite interesting, these possibilities and the limit of the possibilities with his presidency are coming to the fore. So it's all an interesting point in time, I think. But we'll leave that for now and talk about Alaska, which you wanted to go into. So please take it away.
Well, I actually moved to Alaska 6 years ago. I'm originally from Texas. And in Texas, I actually grew up in Amarillo, which at one time had the highest per capita rate of refugees coming into the United States at one point. So I got to see that demographic replacement and see how that works. And in, I think a lot of people would be surprised, like, oh, that happened in, of all places, Amarillo, Texas. But yeah, it does. I don't think they're number one anymore, but that was one reason to move to Alaska was purely strategic relocation. To get here, you either have to fly or you have to cross the Canadian border and come up through, you know, like however many 2,000 miles of Canada or something like that. So, and that's one thing too, that relates back to my whole thing about like Europe as well. In terms of like Alaska being somewhat of a redoubt, even for Europeans, potentially. In terms of our population, we have under 1 million people. We're one of the, Anchorage is one of the most strategically located airports and hubs in the world. Our potential for resources and an economy with the help, you know, of European immigration could blow Texas out of the water in terms of being like eighth in the economy one day. But that relates back into, there's this guy on TikTok, his name's Johannes Klanter, he's Dutch, but, so I apologize about his name, but, that's one thing that he talks about is, you know, Europeans even having a redoubt, whether it be, you know, somewhere further up north or be Alaska or something. And the potential for Alaska and Europeans to make something really great is there for Europeans and also, you know, for whites from the lower 48 to once again become pioneers. And I think that's very important. And that's also very critical of the European spirit. And that's one thing that a lot of Europeans have kind of lost in for certain reasons, but that spirit of pioneerism needs to be reinflamed, and that Europeans, and especially European men especially, there's to become pioneers once again for that last frontier, and what it offers up is, it certainly is what dreams could be made of for a lot of people.
So would you say that is like a last chance for America to become, to sustain it, to continue, to have a new lease of life?
For Americans, yeah, well, so I believe it was called the Northwest Territories. It was a movement that was in like Oregon, Montana, Idaho, and Washington State that was supposed to be, you know, kind of a readout for white Americans to go and to, you know, reestablish and to make businesses and to associate with one another and everything. And to a certain degree, that's kind of, but the potential of Alaska is there. We're not connected and surrounded by everyone else. You know, we're pretty, in a way, we're isolated and we share a border like with the Yukon Territory. I think it has under 50,000 people. And then we also share a border with British Columbia, but there you can't drive from British Columbia into Alaska. It's only through the Yukon Territory. And so it's kind of seems like that Goldilocks zone, that Goldilocks opportunity for our people, if need be. And what it offers up to a person with a pioneer spirit is a life that so many people are devoid of, whether it be because of demographic replacement, whether it be because of the economy, that people can come here and make something of themselves. It's funny because there are Californians that move to Alaska specifically just for the freedom. You hear about Californians moving to Texas and whatnot, but there's a good proportion that move up here to Alaska for the freedom. There's more freedom in Texas. You can do whatever the fuck you want. And
I was going to ask if it's culturally absorbed much from BC, from Canada, or is it still very American?
Oh, it's American. It's American. You can't get more American than, you know, some of us Alaskans in terms of loving football and that type of stuff.
Okay.
All right, so, and I did want to mention one thing, like if Europeans did decide to like make Alaska a redoubt and reestablish themselves here, we certainly could use the architecture. The architecture here is absolutely atrocious.
Right. Well, I mean, there is some good architecture in America, and there used to be a lot more of it in Canada as well. I mean, it's not like the New World does it, but it's really over the last 50 years, isn't it? And then that's affected the Old World as well. It's very unfortunate. But yeah, I think this is an interesting idea. Do you feel a desire to sort of advertise Alaska rather than the more extreme option of people moving back to Europe?
You know, because I actually feel that way too. For one thing, like a lot of Alaskans do not live in Alaska all year. I actually am one of the few that do. There's a good majority of us but you know, that split our time. And so I also kind of see like the whole, you know, moving back to Europe thing is more of something for myself, maybe even splitting that up, is to move to and to live in a place like Scotland and to reestablish and be there and for my children to experience that and to see where they came from. And, but also have Alaska as kind of that safe redoubt and to have our options open. I think that's the important thing. It's, you know, people about moving like to Scotland and picking up and everything like that. What I'm talking about, and I apologize because I am very poor at explaining things. And like I said, this is my first time. I'm totally lost here. But we need to have choices. We need to have options. We need to have backup plans. And I think that doing what is right for not just our people, but what's right for our families is having a backup plan and not giving up, but establishing yourself in a place that you have a connection to your culture and your heritage, but you also are establishing that culture and heritage in a place like Alaska and kind of setting that flag, if you will, and establishing that place, making it a European colony would be a bad way to put it, but more of a readout of a place that is European, that is for Europeans, and have that option for y'all to, you know, come and make Alaska great and make it into a vision and to make it into not like a mini Europe, but make it European.
Yeah, I understand. An extension of Europe. You used the word pioneer, and I think that's an interesting, it's a relevant word to all of this, because obviously one of the things that differentiates America from Europe is that it was the people who were, and a lot of people who went to America ended up coming back to Europe because they couldn't handle, they couldn't handle the need to be a pioneer. They weren't enough of pioneers to manage it. But obviously in the course of the last century or so, I think you've still got that very independent spirit in the American people, perhaps more than in Europe, but it has been thwarted through various ways, the corrupting of the American project, as it were.
Yes.
And so Alaska would be a way for that to, you know, have a new lease of life. It'd be to reignite that spirit.
And I think that even goes back to, you know, whether it be pioneers, but establishing that homestead and building. And that's what we do, is build and make things European and make things in our image. And that is, that's what's needed. But in terms of like young men, whether you be American or European, I think white men do have that streak of independence. They have that want for danger, for adventure. And that's what it is. That's what being a pioneer is. And I think that that is the spirit that needs to be stirred in so many white men. And like with the Woodlander, I mean, the Woodlander, he's, you know, kind of doing off grid and living that way. in a little pocket of, you know, the UK or whatever. But, you know, he has that dream. And so there's that dream to be that independent, that to have that, you know, even in the UK, you know, but to stir that inner spirit of pioneerism within white men. And you always see, you know, the gaming and all of the shit that we do, you know, that is just distracting us from what our true nature is. And that's building, that's being pioneers, and that's making cool shit.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think that this is something that is just naturally in white men, especially when they're young, and it gets thwarted by the modern world, not just in America, I think everywhere. And I think this is the thing that could be our salvation. It could be that spirit, that need for adventure and risk and danger, and the willingness to confront it and, you know, just deal with it. I mean, it's going to be needed anywhere that we hope to survive. You know, anywhere that stands a chance, it's going to be because of that nature of white men. And I mean, it's a cliche to say it, but the modern world really does crush that. It's like it's almost built to do, it's almost custom designed to thwart that in specifically the young white men. So, yeah, I think if you could unleash that somehow and even cultivate it and encourage it, I think you would just immediately see good incredible results. I just wish it was going to be that way with Trump and you know, the people who are currently prominent, like Elon Musk and all that. I wish that they did realize this and would do it.
And I don't think that, once again, working within the system or anything like that is ever going to really, you know, work out for us. It's what's going to happen. It's not until everything finally collapses that finally we can finally get moving and have that freedom to do it whenever we don't have all of these boundaries, whenever we rebuild. And that's one thing, too, about like Alaska is life and death. You see extreme examples and how horrible they are of death, you know, in nature. But you see the absolute beauty that comes from rebirth. And so, like, why are we holding on to this world? Why are we holding on to this? What does it have to offer us anymore? Why are we so afraid of letting go? Why? What are we afraid of? Are we afraid of starting over and rebuilding when that is within us to do so? Why are we holding on to this world? That's what I don't understand, is let it go. You know, reference Frozen, let it go. But we got to let things go. We need rebirth. We need that beauty. We need to, you know, pick ourselves up from the fire, from the destruction, from the rubble, and rise again and rebirth. And that's what's necessary for civilization. I mean, look at how many times Europeans have had to go through that, and look at what happens each time. Great things happen. And so, yeah, why are we so damn afraid of letting go of this and embracing that pioneer spirit, embracing that fire and tumultuousness that's we carry within us to make something great and have rebirth?
Absolutely. I think in the case of Europeans, it's because of rootedness, apart from anything else, but also the stultifying effect of the culture. In the case of Americans, I think it's much more of a doable thing for them, what you're suggesting, because Alaska is within their grasp. They can go there. They can move there easily. I think it's an interesting concept. It's not something that I've thought much about. So it's new to me, but it does seem definitely worth, I think it's something that's definitely worth a lot of consideration by young Americans specifically, that you could do this, that this could be a way for you to have the life of adventure that that your ancestors had, your forefathers had.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, and like I said, sorry.
No, no, you go.
And, you know, and getting back to kind of splitting that of being an Alaskan and reestablishing something new, but also being grounded to the old world and to be immersed in the old world of, you know, Scotland or whatever, of letting my children. I think that that duality is important, especially for Europeans. Europeans need to experience both. They need to experience the pioneerism, but they also, in terms of like Americans, need to experience the old world and see where they came from. And that kind of duality right there of you guys need to get out and be some pioneers and experience that. That's integral to who you are. And but you're already immersed in European culture. You already live there. So like for me and my kids, that would need to be an important thing for them to see and to grow up and have that part of that grounding of European culture.
Definitely. I mean, this is something that I do have a lot of confidence in saying that. I think thoughtful Americans, it's not going to be for all of them, but the thoughtful Americans should definitely be familiar with Europe. They should definitely visit Europe and spend a certain amount of time there just to absorb, you know, an old French village or a German town or whatever, so that they're familiar with the way we have lived for, you know, thousands of years, the way that they are evolved for. It's not supposed to be a car journey to everything, to do everything. Yes. You know, we were evolved for small towns. And it's actually a very nice way to live.
Well, and I think that, you know, so many Americans, they just go to Paris. Oh, they get like, ooh, Paris. Hell, the first time I went to Paris, I was like, where the fuck are all the French people? Like, seriously. But if you go out into Alsace, into Colmar or Igusheim, and you see those more like villages and you see the more natural state and see the natural state of how people are actually supposed to live and not be in the cities, for one thing. And it, really quick, I mean, that was absolutely shocking the first time I went. It was 2012 was the first time I went to Paris, and I rode the train from Charles de Gaulle into Paris, and whoa.
Let's not get into that. The last time I saw Paris was 10 years earlier than that, and it was bad enough then, so I can't even imagine what you saw in 2012.
What was so sad about whenever I did go to Europe, I had this this very picturesque idea of what it would be. And then I got there and I didn't see my own people. I saw graffiti. I saw trash, needles. Those are things that I would have associated with the problems of America. Then whenever I go back to Europe and I see that and I'm like, what? Because that ideal was Europe was always for the Europeans.
Yeah. I think that's an idea that Americans probably have of Europe. And it, as I said, it was true up until the 90s, pretty much. Yeah. But since then, definitely not. But it does still exist in the towns and especially the villages. It's absolutely still there. I would just say that I think Americans should visit that and absorb what it actually is to be a European, because Americans are still Europeans. I mean, they're a specific kind of Europeans, but they're still Europeans. But anyway, let's wrap it up there, because we've been going for an hour and a half, and I've got the next guest due on in about 10 minutes. So let's wrap it up there. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
Thank you for having me on. This has been an absolute honor. Like, I had to pinch myself several times. I apologize. I'm not very polished or anything. And being put on the spot, like with certain questions and whatnot, all this is new to me. But I guess thank you for popping my streaming cherry in a way. I really appreciate that. But I thank you, Woz, for having me on. You know, next time, because we had some other stuff that I wanted to cover about like comparative European folklore to Alaskan folklore, because I actually was going to reference some of Professor Dutton's stuff to reinforce like some stuff about Bigfoot. It's real weird. But you know, always next time and whatnot. But in terms of wrapping things up, I'd like to say to everyone, you know, thank you for watching. Thank you for watching, you know, me go through this. Like I said, I'm totally new. But in terms of going forward, I'd like to say that getting back to Rebirth, that's very important. Going forward, we do not need to be afraid of letting go. What is ahead of us and our people is beautiful. And I think to sum it up, when it comes to our people, is that the best is yet to come.
That's a great note to end on. I should say that there was one super chat from Bob's Vegana.
Said, welcome, I like the name.
Welcome to Millennial Rusty. So thank you for Bob. All right, so this has been good. So thank you. You've done well. Don't worry. I know it's been nerve-wracking, but it's been great.
Well, thank you, Ross.
All right. Okay, excellent. Well, Rusty McCrusty, thank you for taking part in Millennial X. I will be back soon with Anti-Dem, now called Anno Domini, I think. And I'll see you all then. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. See you all later.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available. But no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.